Okay, so we are on lesson four of Judges, which is chapters 6 through 8. And I'm going to do the lesson a little differently today. I'm going to actually kind of teach you the end of it before we actually get into the chapters. And I want to do this because, first of all, these chapters are really important for the book of Judges. And secondly, we still don't talk about this so often that we won't recognize it unless we talk about it first when we see Gideon and what he's doing. You know, whenever Gideon comes up, what do we always think about? The testing with the fleece, right? That's what we always think about. And that's such a little part of the whole story. And the whole story is so important to idolatry that we really need to understand what it is that's being idolized here. Because it's not apparent because it's so part of our life. So that's why I want to talk about kind of the end. This would normally be the end of the lesson before we get into the lesson itself. The first thing I want you to do is I want you to turn your sheets around and I want you to make me some lists. And the first list I want you to write down for yourself. No one's going to look at this. But I want you to write down some of the things that you're afraid of. So some of the things that you're afraid of. And they can be concrete things, like I'm afraid of dogs. But I'm looking for more abstract things. So what are you afraid of in your life? So when you've written three or four things down, if you can continue to go ahead. I want you to write another list. And I want you to write a list of what you don't have enough of. Okay, that was really funny. It's so funny to watch body language. Because as soon as I said you don't have enough of, it was like, that was like immediate. So what you don't have enough of. Have at least a couple of things on there? Everybody's really writing.
Maybe do you want to miss
Yeah. At least, does everyone have at least two or three? Okay. So go ahead and turn your papers over and we'll start there. I want you to leave that alone for a while and then we'll get back to that. Remembering. We always want to go back to what do we remember? What in the world is God doing? What is he always doing?
He's always on his side of the world, like, equipping us for life, redeeming us from death.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Annie! That's the definition of covenant. Woo! That was years ago.
I just was repeating.
That was really good. Yes, he's equipping us for... Say it again.
Equipping us for life, redeeming us from death.
Absolutely. So that's covenant. He's always doing that. That's what he's always doing. So he is redeeming a people, us, so that we can join him in redeeming all peoples, right? And he's doing that by, he's redeeming us from our broken lives, right? Our lives that are trying to be led by Suke or Bios. To our original state of image bearers that create. And how do image bearers create?
Name worth.
Tend. Multiply for flourishment. Okay. So that's what he's always doing. He's always redeeming us from death. He's always redeeming us from following our Suke and Bios. And he's always bringing us to life. He's always equipping us to be able to be image bearers who name, tend, and multiply for flourishing. And he's doing that because he always keeps covenant. Everything he does is about keeping covenant. exactly what Annie just said. And in Judges, he tells us that he keeps covenant by doing two things. By testing us. In other words, we're reflective material, so he's trying to make us more reflective, bringing up all the dross, all the stuff that's marring that reflection. So he does, he keeps covenant in Judges, he tells us, by testing and by
bringing battle.
Two T's.
Teaching war.
So he's always doing it by testing us and by teaching us war. He's teaching us how to fight those things that mar our reflection, how to fight those gods that we kind of take after and start following, which will always be letting our suke and our bios lead. So these are the kind of things that we need to know about Judges so that we understand all the battles in Judges, that they are for our good, that without battles, we wouldn't be the more reflective image that he wants us to be and that will fulfill us. So far in Judges, we've encountered two specific gods. The first week with Ehud and Eglon, what god did we encounter?
Self-satisfaction.
Self-satisfaction, right. Ways that we self-satisfy ourselves, that make ways that we want to make sure that we're comfortable, make sure that we are strong, make sure that we are have good status, have profit. And from those chapters of Judges, we found people satisfying themselves through what means?
Food.
And?
Women.
Women we did. We didn't talk about it, and I didn't put that down, but that is true. That's true throughout. Food and wealth is the other one. So food and wealth. Any excess, really. And we haven't talked about women and the sexual things. One thing you should know, the Canaanite gods, Baal, was the god of fertility. And so every one of these gods that we talk about, underlying is a sexual immorality. And we will get to that and we'll talk about that. But it's always, so to worship Baal, because he is the god of fertility, he brings rain. One of the worship practices was ritual prostitution. So that was how you worship Baal. So when we think about the aberrations of sexual desires being met, how we think they should be met, that's ritual prostitution, according to God. That's worshiping Baal. That's worshiping fertility. It's worshiping our desires, our self-satisfaction. So the God of self-satisfaction. And last week, when we saw Deborah and Yael and Barak, they were battling what god? What were the Canaanites basically known for?
Power.
Yep. So we've seen two gods so far. The god of self-satisfaction and the god of power. And when we talk about power, worldly power, the god of power, we're talking about making sure that our picture gets satisfied, right? That our picture gets accomplished. And so we will use the god of power by manipulating, by managing, by telling instead of asking, by having expectations rather than expectancy. Taylor's working on her wedding now, and she's finding lots of people have expectations for her wedding. And that's not life-giving, is it? Not at all. Expectations are never life-giving. That's a piece of the god of power, is having expectations, and then assuming they're going to be met. So those are the two gods that we've talked about so far, the god of self-satisfaction and the god of power. And we've got to be really aware that we do worship at those gods' altars a lot, so that they're not physical concrete idols for us so much as they are ideas and paradigms. What we found out last week was that there is a response to being able to fight those gods. And that is to be able to receive the naming that God has given us, the worth that God has said that we are. In receiving that call to fight, God says, you're worthy to fight this. You're worthy to cohort. You're very valuable. But we have to receive it. And we saw Barak didn't receive it at first, right? And it took him a while, and it took people coming alongside of him and showing him, giving him examples to be able to do that. But once he did that, he was able to fight. So receiving our naming from God, receiving God saying you're valuable, is essential to be able to join the battle of these gods of power and self-satisfaction. So that's kind of a review of where we've been in Judges. We're going to look at another god this week. The key word in these three chapters, anybody know what perhaps the key word is? What's the attitude here all the time? What do we see constantly in this?
Fear.
There's fear everywhere here, right? I mean, look at the Israelites. Wait till you see where they are and who their enemy is. It's just incredible. But it's definitely fear. Fear is definitely what is controlling everything. And what we need to understand is what is underneath that fear. So it is really an idea of there's just not enough. There's not enough for me. There's not enough of me. There's just not enough. So I want to give you a picture of that. So let's say that we're going on a big hike next week, but it's a major hike. And we're going to, I'm giving you very little direction. Just pack for a hike. Mm-hmm. So we're going to pack for a hike, right? And we're going to think about what we need. So I'm going to think, well, I need, what do I need for a hike?
Water.
Okay, so I need water. So I'm going to, here's my backpack. And I packed water here. So here's water. In fact, I've got two waters, just in case, right? So that I have enough, right? What else might I need for a hike?
Layers.
Do I have layers in here? Oh, I got layers in here, right? Right? Got an extra coat, extra jacket. It might be 80 degrees, but you never know, right? You got to pack it, right? Wouldn't you do that, right? Mm-hmm. So when did we go to Utah?
May.
In May, Sherilyn had a birthday and invited 10 women from all across the country to go to Utah with her. And so we had to pack like this. We had to decide, well, we had no idea what it was going to be like, so we had to make sure we had enough, right? Enough clothing. So every woman brought a suitcase, right? Everyone brought a suitcase, right? Some more, some less, just to make sure we had enough. So within that suitcase, we definitely all had jackets. I think it was 80 degrees, mm-hmm. Yeah? So we made sure we had that. Oh, what else?
Chocolate.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you know what? I think we all brought chocolate. We did. We all brought chocolate. But we definitely want food, right? And how much food should we bring?
How long is the hike?
Extra.
Extra, right? Yeah. Extra food. In fact, here's a list from the 10 essentials you need when you go hiking. And one of them is food. And one of them is water. And in parentheses, next to food and water, it says extra. Extra water, extra food. So you have any idea, remember the amount of money we spent on food?
I know what my share was it was almost $100, like each person, I think, for food.
Was it an
overnight hike?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a couple days.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. But we could not fit all the groceries in this kitchen. We could not
outside.
We had to get two coolers.
You had $1,000 worth of food.
Yes.
To fit all the food we had to. Because
what if you're hungry?
What if you're hungry? What if we don't have enough? Right? What if we don't have enough?
Then you have to have since food's perishable, you have to think about that too.
Right. So now, in order to have enough, now we need other things to be able to keep the enough stuff, right? So maybe this backpack isn't going to be big enough. Maybe I'll bring two backpacks.
You need a
right?
wheel.
Get a trailer.
Get a little, and they have backpacks with wheels now.
You need a wheel. a mule.
So I'm going to fill my backpack so that I have enough, right? And when I bring this backpack with me, will I feel like I have enough?
You're going to get too much when you put that on.
But I'm going to carry this, and as I'm carrying, I'm going to think, oh, I didn't bring this, right? So on the trip, oh, I didn't bring a hairdryer. And that was a big deal for all of us.
You don't need that on a hike. Where are you
going to
plug it in
the woods? But what if you go
up
to dinner later?
Also, it was a hike.
Oh, it was a birthday party, remember this. So it's in Utah. I mean,
well, there are two different kinds of hikes. There, you
there are lots of hikes.
Yeah. There are many different kinds.
You have many different kinds.
If you're not going to take a hairdryer.
Maybe. It depends on who you are.
A high maintenance hike. Yeah.
So we have this wonderful time, and Michelle's right, we did go out to dinner, so we knew we were going to go into town for dinner, and we knew that, but we were also told this is minimalist, you just bring hiking clothes, nobody needs to bring anything or makeup or anything like that. Was there anyone who didn't bring makeup? Everybody brought makeup. So we're all getting dressed.
Self-protection. Yeah,
exactly. We're all getting dressed, and I look at everybody. Now, I'm the oldest by far. Like, all of these are young women. Michelle, I think, is the next age
probably
down, right? But these, I mean, Sherilyn was turning 40. So I'm looking at all of them, and they are dolled up. Like, we're going out to dinner, and I thought this was minimalist. So I had a hiking dress on and sandals. They were not only, they had the cute, I mean, Sherilyn had cowboy boots, and just all the stuff. I don't know how she carried it.
I was like, how are you taking cowboy boots?
But here's what I noticed. Not only did they have makeup on and really cute outfits on, they also had lots of jewelry on. So I'm going, and I'm looking at Sherilyn. She stayed in her room, and I'm looking. She's got all this jewelry. I thought, maybe I should ask her for some. I have none with me. I'm going on a hike. So I'm literally, but remember, I'm not going to be vulnerable. I'm not going to say to everybody, I didn't bring jewelry. Can somebody lend me some jewelry? I'm looking around the house. Everyone's wearing jewelry. And I see, so this house is packed with just interesting artifacts all over the place. And one of the artifacts is something that looks like it could be jewelry. It matches what I'm wearing. I put it on. It looks great. And people said, I love your necklace. Thank you. Oh, it's an artifact from the house.
It was awesome.
It was pretty cool. I don't even know what it was. But
I don't remember.
It worked well. Here's the deal. I was so afraid of not being enough, right? I wanted to make sure that I fit in. That I'm enough for this, because I'm already not enough because I'm older than everybody else, and I'm an introvert, which 88 out of the 10, I think, were extroverts. So I'm already feeling.
Me and you.
Yeah, right, exactly. But I want to make sure I'm enough, so I'm going to take lots of stuff. I'm going to take a backpack full of stuff. Now, what this means, though, is, oh my gosh, I'm going to be carrying this around, right? But maybe I'll have enough. I'm already.
Do that next weekend.
You can bring this. You're not going to need it.
Okay.
But this is pretty much how we walk around because we don't feel we have enough. We walk around with all sorts of added things just in case we don't have enough. So I want you to picture this because the God that we're going to talk about is the God of scarcity. The God that says, there's not enough. There's limited resources. And you probably aren't enough. So that's the God that we're going to talk about with Gideon and the Midianites. So I want you to picture that. I might even have each of you carry this around for a while. Because it's a great picture of scarcity. So I want to talk about scarcity. Now, we've talked about this in a couple other classes before. But it's so important because it is so part of our culture that we are unaware, first of all, that it's a God. And we're unaware that it actually leads us into the other gods. It actually is the foundation for wanting a God of power and wanting a God of self-satisfaction. So that we have enough. So that we are enough. So. Let me ask you. What is it on your list that you felt like you didn't have enough of?
Time.
Time. And you know what? That's always number one, at least here. Time.
Time with my husband.
Energy. Yeah, enough time, enough energy. Mm-hmm. What else?
Patience.
Patience, enough patience.
I put control of my kids' future.
Oh, I don't have enough control of my kids' future. What else?
Money.
Money.
Health.
Health. Mm-hmm. So I want you to think about those things as we go through this God of scarcity or this paradigm of scarcity. And I think we do much better when we say a paradigm rather than a God. But the other paradigms other than God's paradigm are gods. That feeling of not having enough, of there are not enough resources to go around for me. There is not enough of me, that I'm not enough. Underlying fear is the idea of unworthiness. I'm not enough. Almost all fear, the issue is actually, I'm not enough, I don't have enough. It's the God of scarcity. Scarcity thrives when everyone is hyper aware of lack. Lack of safety, which I would say is where America is right now, right? We're hyper aware that we're not safe enough. That's all the news is talking about all the time, right? Hyper aware of not enough possessions or resources. Hyper aware of not enough belonging or love. Hyper aware. When a culture is hyper aware of lack, the God of scarcity has taken over. Scarcity also thrives when so many in the community are struggling with worthiness. And so many are struggling with worthiness that it begins to shape culture. We saw this last week in the culture of Israel. Because we noticed that it was the men who were not taking their leadership positions. Barak was the case study, but that he was just an example of all of the men. They were not feeling worthy to lead. They were having issues of their own worthiness because they hadn't looked to God for their worthiness, right? God says, look to me and you'll reflect me and you'll see that you are my image. So there was a community struggling. So many people struggling with worthiness that it began to shape their culture. And that's why Deborah says, I, a mother, had to rise up in Israel because so many were struggling with worthiness. And it also happens, scarcity paradigm, living in that, also happens when a culture, a people, or even an individual has been through so much. There's just been through so much. And instead of coming together to heal, they react with anger and shame. They react with anger and fear. So Israel, up to this point, has been through a lot. And one of the things God wants them to do is come together, right? Cohort is his whole idea. We're one. Come together and you heal. But when they don't do that, when they choose instead to react with anger and fear, that is a place where scarcity really flourishes. what happens when scarcity flourishes is that a lifestyle begins to come out. And the reason a different lifestyle happens is because with scarcity happening, there's two losses that happen. One is the loss of a willingness to own your own vulnerability, a willingness to be vulnerable. You lose that when you begin to think there's not enough, when you're not enough. Now I'm not willing to be vulnerable. I'm not willing to share my weaknesses. I'm not willing to be honest about that. That gets lost in a culture of scarcity. And I'm not making this up. I definitely am getting it from scripture, but this is sociological research that this happens in all cultures. The first thing to be lost is a willingness to be vulnerable. And the second thing that is lost is an ability to engage the world from a place of worthiness. So I don't come at the world and what's going on in my life from a place of worthiness. I know who I am. I know what my identity is, and I'm content in that and secure in that. I can't come from that if I'm living in a culture of scarcity. It's really difficult because the God of scarcity keeps saying, you're not enough. And I haven't turned my face to the one source that says, you're enough. So, because of that, scarcity begins to push us toward all sorts of other gods. The God of self-satisfaction. I will begin to self-satisfy my felt needs and desires because I don't think that I'll get enough following God's ways. I don't think that I'll be satisfied enough with God's ways. God's ways will just not give me enough. Now, will I verbalize that? No. That is what I'm unconsciously doing. I really don't feel that God's ways are going to be enough for me. I will also use the God of power. I will manage, I will manipulate, I will control people and circumstances to make sure that my picture gets fulfilled because I really don't think God's picture is fulfilling enough. I really don't think it's going to give me enough. So do you see how insidious the God of scarcity is? It begins to push us towards all the other gods. It's why Judges spend so much time on Gideon. Three chapters as compared to a couple verses on Othniel, which is actually the first judge who actually goes toward God's desires. Gideon has three chapters. This is a foundational God that actually makes us go toward other gods. This idea of scarcity, buying into that picture that scarcity is the truth. The cultural manifestations, as the researchers tell us, are three things. Number one, shame. So the culture begins to be molded by shame. The fear of ridicule and belittling is how we control each other in a culture of scarcity. We use comparisons a lot. A lot of comparisons, a lot of ranking. And when comparisons and ranking are happening a lot, creativity is suffocated. So no one's going to be unique. It's going to be very difficult to be unique. So you're going to see more and more homogeneousness. So we look at our churches, right? Do we all look alike? It's so funny to walk into church because you look at everybody's dressed the same, right? It's so funny because it just depends on where you go. If you go to the South, different, but they're all the same down there, right? Mm-hmm. And this homogeneity becomes a piece of living in a culture of scarcity. I don't want to wear what I like. I don't want to look what I like because I want to be enough. And so I'm going to make sure that I gather in what everybody else is gathering in. So, shame. Comparison, And disengagement. That's the other thing about a culture of scarcity. People will be afraid to take risks. It's easier to stay quiet than to share my stories and experiences. So in a culture of scarcity, you will not see vulnerability. You will not feel that you can or want to share who you are, what struggles you're going through. Because in a culture of scarcity, already you're being told you're not enough. So,
ask you a question.
Yeah.
This may be off topic, but just listening to all this, it makes me think of how you just went to court. All of this sounds, do you know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Did you have all that feeling?
Yep.
Like while you were
yep.
there?
I'm going to actually talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly how I felt.
Okay.
That's exactly how I felt. The personal repercussions, this is how people will begin to act, is they will hide, they will hoard, and they will exploit. They will hide to avoid vulnerability. I'm going to put a mask on, right? I am not going to let people see who I am. I'm not going to let people see my faults, my weaknesses, my vulnerabilities. I'm not going to do that. Hoard. You're going to keep everything here, right? You're going to insulate yourself. You're going to protect yourself from being hurt, which is just the opposite of vulnerability. Vulnerability says, I'm willing to be wounded for another's sake. And exploiting, I will make sure to use people and things to assure myself that I can get enough. So the question is, if I don't have enough time, if I don't have enough money, if I don't have enough patience, what is it that I don't have enough time for? So let's answer that question.
My picture.
I don't have enough time for my picture to get accomplished. I don't have enough time for, what else?
Family.
I don't have enough time for
work.
I don't have enough time for rest. I don't have enough time for
yourself.
Exercise. Okay? We can fill in the blank lots, right? What do I not have enough money for?
Tuition.
Tuition. Stuff. Stuff.
Stuff.
I don't have enough time. I don't have enough money for stuff.
Like that Madame Blueberry, that VeggieTales
Blueberry. I don't have enough time for that. Underlying that is, I don't have enough time to be that picture of who I want to be, which is exactly what Kristen said, right? That picture of who I want to be is the person who kind of can do it all, right? I have a picture of who I should be. So really, I don't have enough time, I don't have money, I don't have enough patience to be the mom that I have a picture of. I don't have time and patience to be the Christian woman that I'm supposed to be. I don't have enough time to be all of that. But what is our identity? We only have one identity. And what is that?
Image of God.
What do you need to be the image reflector of God? Yeah, so what do you need? One thing.
God,
right? It's all you actually need to be an image of God, to be a reflector of God. It's all you need. So instead of this backpack, all I really need is one backpack which has living water in it, right? So this is the backpack. Very light, and it's got this connection, right? That I think this is weird, but this is what they are, yeah. Right? And I can't use them because I don't know how to do them.
It's a straw.
It's a spike.
You know what? Oh, I have such a funny story about that. I won't tell you about this. I actually threw up trying to do that.
Oh.
And then laughed hysterically because I just can't figure out how to do that. Anyway. This, yeah. This is all I need is living water, right? I only need God to be the image of God. That's all I need. Do you see what happens when I don't receive my identity as image of God? And I have all these other roles that I decide are my identity, then I need that, right? Because to be a good mom, I need patience, I need money, I need time, right? And I'm going to stuff it Mitch, I might need more stuff, right? I might need a good car. I might need a lot of people to help me. I might need all this. So I'm going to stuff this to make sure I'm a good mom. So do you see what happens when I'm not receiving the image of God, mm-hmm. and carrying him with me, looking at him? I'm going to change backpacks, and I'm going to get this because I'm going to need a lot of stuff because I don't have enough. I will never have enough to be another identity. I will always have enough to be the image of God. Do I have enough time to be the image of God? Whatever time I have is enough to be the image of God, right? Do I have enough money to be the image of God? Whatever I have is enough to be the image of God. Do I have enough patience to be the image of God? Whatever I have is enough to be the image of God. Do you see the vast difference, and yet how easy it is for us to go there rather than there? This is the God of scarcity. When we buy into the God of scarcity, we are taking off our image of God. We are taking off God as our reflector, as what we're reflecting. So, with that slight background, and we can talk a lot about scarcity because it's so prevalent, but now we're going to look at Gideon and we're going to see how the whole nation has bought into this idea of scarcity and how it will affect the country of Israel, the people of Israel, and even Gideon. So we start with the enemy. And who's the enemy in these three chapters?
Midian.
So the Midianites are the enemy. And I think it's really interesting. I think it's always interesting to go back to the root of who these people were. So we talked about going back to some of the daughters of Lot and their incestuous relationship with their father, and how that brings in these people. Because what we see is, and you know, sometimes I get nervous, like, am I just making this up that I see this? So I did talk with my professor last night. I said, this is what I see with the Midianites. Is this true? And he said, oh, yeah. He said, what you're going to see is the personality of the original descendant actually starts flowing through the people. I mean, God says the sins of the father will be visited, right, on the third and fourth generation. That's kind of what it is that way of life, that paradigm becomes a part of that people. So Midian, anybody know who Midian was, the very first Midian? He was the son of Abraham. Abraham and? No, Keturah, his third wife, concubine. When Sarah dies, Abraham goes and marries Keturah. Now, I want you to think about that. What had God promised Abraham?
Great nation.
Great nation, descendants. Through where was that? Were those descendants going to come? Through Sarah and Isaac, right? When Abraham makes the choice after Sarah dies to go and get another wife with other children, what is he saying?
Not enough.
I don't have enough. Maybe God's going to need to supply it with my big backpack.
He's 120 years old.
And I thought about that. Oh my goodness, he's 120 years old, and he gets a lot more kids, right? With
men
Keturah.
Just can't live alone. They just have to have a wife. At our church, we have 80 widows, and I think 15 widowers.
And I get it, right? That desire and need, but what does God keep telling us? I'm enough.
Yeah.
I'm enough. And even Abraham, even after all the stuff that he's given God, even after a great faith that he has, he still falls under that, I don't have enough. And so he marries Keturah, which is where Midian comes from. So we have the Midianites now, centuries later, being the cause of the God of scarcity being prevalent. Now, the interesting thing about Midian is what Abraham does with his children that he has with Keturah. Anybody know what he does with them?
Well, they end up Ishmaelites. So
well, from Ishmael, but now these are kids from Keturah. So we had Ishmael first, then he has Isaac
so
with
the
Keturah.
The Midianites are not Ishmaelites.
No.
I read that wrong then.
So and here's the thing: when you see the names of people, a lot of times they use names to group a lot of people. So remember we talked about Canaanites? Mm-hmm. All of them are considered Canaanites. At one time, they were all considered Amorites or Amalekites. Ishmaelites, whenever you see the word Ishmaelite, it usually means people who are nomads.
Oh, okay.
So Ishmael was nomadic people. And so anytime you see a nomadic people, the word for nomad is Ishmael.
Okay.
That's where you see that. So Midian is a child of his third wife, along with a whole bunch of others. What Abraham does is, and this is exactly what it says, while he was still living, he gave gifts to those children and sent them away from Isaac and his inheritance. What do you think that did to those children?
They're bitter.
Bitter. Shamed.
Right? That Keturah was a concubine?
It says both concubine and wife.
Oh.
Yeah. I know.
So that's what made her a concubine, probably, is that the children were disinherited, maybe?
Right. Yeah.
Think about what Abraham's desire of not having enough did. He fathered these children, and then he said to these children, I'm ashamed of you. Go away from Isaac and the inheritance. Do you see what happens? When I believe that I don't have enough, and I start gathering more, whether it be children or whatever, I affect a lot of people. So Abraham not only affects those, I think it was five or six children he had with Keturah, but he affects a whole nation. Midian becomes a nation, and now Midian is the enemy of Israel, which is really interesting because Midian is not one of the enemies that God says to fight against. They don't live in the land. Midian lives south in Arabia. I have Moab. They were tented in Moab. That's not where they live. They were south. They're coming into the land to grab the stuff and going back out again. They don't even live in Israel. But what also happened with Midian is right before, in Exodus, right before Israel comes into the land, they are seduced by Midian women to play the harlot with the Midian women. When Moses had just told them, when we go through Moab, make sure you do not play the harlot with the women there. And the Midianite women, I think by the instruction of their leaders, seduce the men of Israel. So this is what we know of Midian. They've been born in shame because Abraham didn't feel he had enough. They have already shamed Israel when Israel first came into the land. So there is a huge history for them and Midian about shame and scarcity. And now they're coming into the land and they are establishing a culture of fear and scarcity. Israel doesn't feel worthy enough to defend their own land. These are not people who are living there. These are people who are coming in, taking all of their crops, and leaving. And Israel, what's Israel doing?
They're hiding.
Mm-hmm. Which right away you know, they're under the God of scarcity. They're feeling like they're not enough to meet this. Midian's already shamed them. They're already feeling ashamed, and they're not enough. So we have Midian then exploiting them. And this is economic exploitation. It is telling Israel, you aren't even enough to eat your own food. Can you imagine how that feels as a father and a provider that I can't even feed my family? I'm growing the food, and I can't even feed my family the food I'm growing. Do you think that happens today anywhere?
Mm-hmm.
That economic exploitation creates a culture of scarcity?
Mm-hmm.
My son-in-law lived in Ethiopia for 2 years, and he brought back to us Ethiopian coffee. He said, it's some of the best coffee. And I said, did you drink that a lot there? He said, oh, no, not allowed. Ethiopians are not allowed to drink their own good coffee. It's for export only. They have to drink a very inferior, muddy, yucky coffee. They're not allowed. Absolutely not allowed. Ben could not drink that in there. I think as an American, he could go and buy it and get it. But as an Ethiopian, not allowed. And where were they exporting it to? U.S., yeah. U.S., Britain, yeah. That is a culture of scarcity. That is economic exploitation. So we still see that today, and that's what happens in a culture of scarcity. So that's Midian. So we have the Midianites using fear and exploiting it, using it for their own benefit. We're going to take the crops. And so what they came in is they would come in with all of their numbers, and they would take everything that they had grown. It was almost like they're just waiting. Let them grow it, let them grow it, let them grow it. And then they come in and they take it for their own use. So we have Israel, of course, Judges says, does evil. They, first of all, are fearful to the point of hiding. And they're hiding in caves. They have homes here. Remember, they've been here now for a while. We know that they have homes here. They're not living in their homes. They're living in caves. They're ashamed. And obviously, if you are leaving your house to live in a cave, you are ashamed. You feel that you aren't strong enough to defend your own land and your own food. You can't feed your family, and I can't be seen. And they are absolutely disengaged. So all the things we said are the earmarks of cultures of scarcity. That's Israel right now. They are absolutely disengaged. They are not at all. These marauders come in and they're in the caves. Just let them take it and go. They are not standing up for what is theirs and what God has given them. They don't feel worthy enough. In fact, they've even put outside of their caves altars to the gods there. Look, look, we're good, we're good. It's kind of like, look, 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 we're doing what you think is good. And there we have altars to the other gods. Yeah.
I totally think of Bug's Life. And all the ants go in and the locusts come. And
oh, yeah.
They put it up on them.
That's so. That's really good. Yeah. Does anybody know what she's talking about? That movie. Yeah, that's a really perfect picture. That's what Israel's just like. So we have them disengaged, and then, of course, we have them crying. And the interesting thing about their crying is they're crying. They don't like this, which is good, right? They're reaching for God's connection. But the problem is they have no idea why they're in this position. They have no idea. Gideon says, we have no idea why you've abandoned us. When we've already heard God brings a fight against the God that you have succumbed to, that you have submitted to. So what is God going to do then for Israel in this point? Because they have no idea why they're in that position, they've completely forgotten what God says, he's going to remind them. So he first sends them a prophet. And he says, I want to remind you of what I've done. I brought you up. I brought you out. I've delivered you from oppression. I dispossessed your enemies. I gave you land. I told you that I am your source of life. And I told you don't have to fear the gods, because I'm enough for you. But you have forgotten. You've forgotten that I'm enough and that I've always been enough for you. The truth is there is no scarcity in cohort. Your fear of the God of scarcity is actually naming worth to that paradigm. You are basically saying that it is valuable. It's necessary for me to succumb, to submit to that idea of scarcity, so that I propel myself to get enough stuff. It's every time I submit to the God of scarcity, to that paradigm, there's not enough, I don't have enough, I am saying I need to think about the fact that I don't have enough. I need to say that that's true. I'm giving it value. I am worth making it say that's true. And I've got to know that's true so that I get enough stuff. Because what happens if I don't have enough stuff? It is a worship of the God of scarcity. Every time I succumb to that, every time I say, I don't have enough, I'm not enough, that is submitting to the God of scarcity. That is giving value to the God of scarcity. That's worshiping the God of scarcity. I think God, in remembering what I did for you, remember that I'm enough. I think he would want to say, do you remember the manna situation? I said I would give you enough. Don't gather more. What happened when you gathered more? It rotted. I'm enough. I know exactly what you need. I'll give it to you when and how you need it. You don't need to be gathering all sorts of stuff to fill up your backpack. I am enough. It didn't help you to gather more for the manna. Is it now, I think he says to Israel, is it now helping you that you're hiding? Is that giving you enough life? I mean, it's a ridiculous picture that Israel thinks that this is a good idea, that they should be hiding because this will give them life, right? And we think, if I hide who I am, if I hide my vulnerabilities, if I hide my weaknesses, that will give me life. Does it? Does it give you life to make sure that no one knows that you have weaknesses? Mm-hmm. Of course it doesn't. But we always think it does. We always think it's a good idea not to be vulnerable. And we think that because we don't like the pain that's associated with that. And that's where Israel is. What God is warning them with the prophet is, fear is an issue of worship. When you fear, you are ascribing worth to the God of scarcity. You are saying, God is not enough. It indicates that you believe that scarcity is the truth. That there is only so much to go around. That there is only so much worthiness to go around, so much honor to go around. And you're going to need to grab it, because there's only so much. Every time I think about this idea of scarcity and worthiness, I think about a piñata. Right? I actually thought about putting up a piñata and watching everybody go for it. Now, if I put candy in it, only those people who we need chocolate to go on our thing would go for it. But what if I put in dollar bills?
$100 bills.
What if I actually put capsules of time in there? Oh, yeah. Every one of us would be scrapping to get it, right? And think about the picture of you've seen of kids going for a piñata. And the funny thing is, almost always a piñata is in the middle of a party where the table is full of stuff, right? But man, that piñata breaks open, and what do you see? Mayhem, right?
And people risk their lives to get the
And they do, and I've seen more injuries with piñata parties than anything else. That is a picture of scarcity. There's not enough. I've got to get it all. I mean, Halloween, right? This is what we do, right? And we come home and we... Okay, so everybody knows I that used to be, I loved it. I loved pouring out the candy and seeing mounds of candy. And then looking at the mound of candy of my sister. Oh, you got 3 Snickers? I only got 2 Snickers. What happened? Comparison, right? I'm going to compare. That always comes out of this idea of scarcity.
That's the way I always felt before Southwest issues numbers. And it was just A group and B group.
Oh my gosh.
They were pushing
that, you know what? I actually was behind somebody who had an altercation over it. I mean, huge. A woman and a man screaming. And I thought they were going to get into a fist fight. The stewardess had to separate them and tell them where they needed to stand. They're so afraid they're not going to get enough. They're not going to get the best seat.
Even now, though, people freak out if they're not exactly in order.
Oh, my gosh. And they say, what number do you have? Oh, yeah. You need to stand behind me. I mean, it is this, I've got to get what I deserve, right? Let's bring it home even more. How about your shopping? When you're shopping, they have that on sale somewhere else. You could get it cheaper. We've talked about this a couple years ago, right? I want to get as much as I can for my money, right? Ladies, that's a God of scarcity mentality. I grew up with that. I was always, my mother was always about where can you get it the cheapest? So that we want to find it at its cheapest. And we never think about what's behind that, right? Who am I exploiting to get this cheaper? So I can get the same thing at 10,000 Villages as I can get at Target. And at Target, it's going to be a lot cheaper. What does that mean? Somebody's getting a lot less money for it. Do you think it's Target? Nope. It's the people who made it. Same thing at 10,000 Villages is more expensive because they gave the money to the people who made it. Target does what we do with coffee in Ethiopia. We're going to give you this much money and we're going to sell it at this cheaper price. So this idea of not enough is an issue of worship, of where you're ascribing worth. And we ascribe worth at getting as much as we can for ourselves, whether it be as much as we can for our money. We think that is prudent. We call it stewardship, right? Yeah. We put a beautiful word on it, and we say, well, this is good stewardship. Where did that come out? That is a really odd idea. When we parse that out, that's a really odd idea that good stewardship is getting as much as we can for our money. Yeah, exactly. So it's that idea. That is an issue of worship. What are you valuing? What are you putting worth to? What are you ascribing worth to? So God says, I'm warning you, this is what you're doing. This is an issue of worship. Because although they had physical things of worship, they were not saying we're not worshiping God. But God was saying, you aren't worshiping me. You can only wear one of those backpacks. You're either wearing that backpack or that backpack. You're not going to wear both. That is superfluous, right? Because I got this that could hold a lot of my own water. You won't carry both. And God says, when you're worshiping the God of scarcity, you're not worshiping me. You cannot worship both. Israel felt like they could worship both. We feel like we can worship both.
Jill, District 204 right now, they've been sending a lot of emails about a new estate bill that's going to restructure the amount of money that we get, SB 16 or whatever. Mm-hmm. Maybe you know more about it than I do. But there's like,
more than you want to know.
There's like panic in all these emails that we're going to have to cut, we're going to get so much less, all this stuff. And I'm thinking, well, what's behind it? Are other areas getting more that need it? I'm imagining that's what's happening, although I don't know all the details. But it's just kind of funny because I feel a little embarrassed because my district has plenty, you know.
Well, we bought our houses in Naperville, though, and so we deserve that better education, you know. I'm not agreeing. That's the mentality, yeah. You know.
Yeah, and they're, oh, we're going to have to cut this or that, and I'm thinking, I'm imagining that this restructuring is allowing another district that has, like, nothing.
Send me down textbooks.
They have some updated textbooks.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, they're having town meetings, and, you know,
yes.
Everybody complain, but I'm feeling that that's exactly
yep.
what's happening
yep.
in Garrison City for
yep.
our wealthy district.
Yes, yes.
Okay, I'm a little confused, though, because I don't see getting... Okay, the Israelites, they're hiding.
Mm-hmm.
They're fearful. So why is that a God of scarcity? Because they're fearful that they can't do anything?
Okay, so remember what happens with the gods. Anytime we follow God, eventually the God starts oppressing us. So So they've been following this goddess Yodi. They've been trying to get enough. And now somebody else is doing it to them, right? You're not going to have enough. So now they're hiding. It's always a result of that. So it's a result of them having gone against the god of scarcity. So that's what we always see with these enemies is they're being oppressed because they actually worshipped that. Okay? So what does God do? First of all, he warns. This is what it is. It's worship. You're worshiping the god of scarcity. You've been worshiping it, and now you're being oppressed by it. And I want you to be oppressed by it so that you realize it's not giving you life. So it's, at this point, they're going, we're hiding in caves. Is this life? He wants them to viscerally feel that this is not life. Then what he does, he goes to Gideon, and it's so beautiful because, of course, he names Gideon. And the first way he names him is with his presence. And he says, the Lord is with you. When we show up to be with someone, we're saying, you're valuable. You're worth my time, right? I told you I was going to share about my court experience, and that reminds me of that. So my court experience last week was such a picture of this. I have never been in a place where I felt more worthless. This was traffic court. And I walked in there right away, a voice of, get over there, of shame. It was absolute shame. Get over there. You make sure you go down the center aisle. You register. Do not talk. Do not say anything. Sit down. And then we have a speech by the bailiff. And this speech was the most intimidating thing I have ever heard. If you have tattoos, if you have piercings in your ear, if you have piercings on your tongue or your nose, take them out. You may not approach the bench looking that way. You may not approach the bench in indecent formal wear. And I'm thinking, my earrings. If you have earrings, you may leave them in. And kind of, we'll give you that. If you look on your ticket and it says you can plead not guilty, if you're here, you cannot plead not guilty. You are guilty here. If you've come here, you are guilty. If you do this, you add this. Do not make sure you stand in front of the podium, not on the side of the podium. If you stand on the side of the podium, you could be in contempt of court. So all these things are, you could be in contempt of court. If you are in contempt of court, it will cost you $50 up to 5 years in prison. For standing on the side of the podium? On and on and on and on. If you may not talk, if you talk, you could be in contempt of court. And I'm sitting there, like, I was already nervous about going in. I told you that. I'm like, oh my gosh, now I can't. Now, so Linda went with me. And I'm sitting there, and I so want to say, oh my word. It was absolutely, oh, stand in these lines. Do not move out of those lines. Make sure that you stand in those lines. When your name is called, you approach the bench. If you start rattling in your pocket for papers and everything, you will be called in contempt of court. And I'm thinking, what in the world? I am so ashamed. Exactly what I felt was, I'm bad. We're all bad. We're bad people. Every one of us in here are bad people. Except Linda, because she was just with me. And I wondered, because we walked out of there, and I looked at her, I said, that was the most intimidating thing I've ever been through. And she said, well, you know, maybe because you were on the spot. But I did wonder, did you feel a little bit like, I want to make sure everyone knows that I'm not here, I'm just here for her. You know, some of that, it is this idea of shaming, right? This intimidation. And you just feel, and literally you felt so stupid that you didn't even want to ask a question. Well, don't talk. Don't do any of that thing. So when God comes to Gideon and says, the very first thing he says is, the Lord is with you. That's what Linda was for me. I'm with you. And I told her later, I was so thankful she was there, because if I was there alone, I'm not sure I wouldn't have started crying. It was that intimidating. her being there and me being able to talk out later, and I just went on and on, like, that was ridiculous. Why did they do that? That being with is a major reminder that we are worthwhile, that we are valuable. Linda reminded me that of that. God reminds Gideon, you're valuable. I'm with you. The fact that I'm with you says you're valuable. You're worth my time and my presence. And then he calls him, O valiant warrior. And of course, we think it's funny, right? Because what's Gideon doing? He's hiding in the wine press. And yet God says, Gideon, you're a valiant warrior. It's what his name means. He's a feller, a hewer down of trees, a warrior. Gideon, that is who you are. I'm reminding you that you are worthwhile, that you are valuable. And when he does this, he does it in the midst of his shame and his fear and his weakness. So he's threshing wheat in the wine press, right? Threshing wheat was to be done on the highest top of the hill that you could get, top of the mountain, in the most open place. Because how they thresh wheat, right, would be to do this so that the wind could take the chaff away. That was how they would separate it. So it's in the most open, free place on top. It is like the most public thing you can do is thresh wheat. Which, of course, then we think about the fact of when we see Ruth, right? We see Ruth going onto the threshing floor. Very public. Like out there, everybody could see. And yet he's in the wine press, and the wine press is actually on the bottom of the hill. Because the wine press, of course, if you're carrying all these grapes down, you're going to want to go down the hill, not up, right? So the wine press is down in the lowest place. And the wine press, always in Scripture, is a picture of abundance. And yet here, the wine press is empty because it's being filled with Gideon's hiding. And there he is, trying to thresh wheat in a wine press. Impossible. Can't do it. There's no wind. It's usually a pit. So a wine press is usually a pit. There's no wind to take the chaff away. So it's an exercise in frustration to fill the wine press with my hiding rather than the abundance of God. And yet this is where God says, Gideon, I'm with you. You're valuable. You are a warrior. And you're valuable because I am with you. Last weekend, we went to my sister-in-law's 60th birthday party, which is where these flowers are from. And, you know, it was a family party, a couple friends. But the governor of Indiana came, stopped by, wished Liz a happy birthday, talked to us. And that fact that he came, that he made an appearance for her, says, you're valuable. You're worthy. Now, of course, yes, he's a politician. Yes, that's good for his politician. But the fact is, the fact that he's there says Liz is valuable. We're valuable because God is with us. We are valuable because he says, I'm taking my presence with you. I'm using my time to be with you. So God warns first that fear is an issue of worship. And then he names, you're valuable. And then what he does to Gideon, I think, is the coolest thing, because he continues to do this. Gideon answers when God says, I'm with you, you valiant warrior. And Gideon actually is angry. Gideon is like, oh, really? Where have you been all this time? Why are we in this place if you've been with us? You're not with us. You've abandoned us. He's angry. And what you need to know about anger from all the sociology research, anger is actually a secondary emotion that's hiding shame. So when there is someone that's angry, underneath it is shame. That's what's being dealt with. And that's what's happening with Gideon is. There is such shame for Gideon, but he's going to put it out as anger. Because what happened, why we choose anger as opposed to saying I'm ashamed, is it forces the focus not on us, right?
The other person.
Somewhere else, right?
And there's less vulnerability and anger.
Absolutely. I get to hide while you get to be on the hot seat. And that's what Gideon does. That's how he knows how to deal with his shame. He has not been able to see the fact that God is actually working in this. That their oppression by the Midianites is God's hand. God's hand so that they will fight this God of scarcity. And God turns to him. And I love it says God turned toward him. It's such a beautiful phrase there. God turns toward him with assurance and says, your strength is in my sending you. He says, go in this your strength. I have sent you. I'm sending you. That's where your strength is. What he does is he talks to his shame, not his anger. He doesn't answer his anger because his question is, where have you been? He doesn't answer that because that's really not what Gideon wants to know. Gideon wants to know that he has worth. Gideon wants to know that God thinks he has worth, that there's shame. Gideon doesn't even know that. He just knows he's ashamed. God speaks to his shame and says, look, you have worth because I'm sending you. I'm trusting you. I'm actually putting my trust that you're going to accomplish for my people what needs to be accomplished.
So I remember last year when I kind of shared about my dad and I getting this massive fight last summer, and it was very painful, but God was so cool because he did this to me. He, as I prayed about what to say to my dad, he impressed on me to call and tell him that I'm not ashamed of him. I mean, exactly. That's exactly what he told me to tell him.
Yep.
And I named a few things that I was proud of him about. And it did, our relationship was so much better this summer.
Yes.
And, yeah, even since then I've seen my dad change a little bit. He found someone who was in need up at the lake. Mm-hmm. And he's raising $6,000 to put a roof on someone's house. Yeah. This is so not my dad. I'm like, wow, I never even knew that that would make that much difference in his life or whatever, but
it's
cool because God did lead me that way.
Right, he led you exactly that way, and that is what makes us disengage so much is shame. And when we open up, when God opens it up for us, and we open up for others to say, you're valuable, there's so much good about you, it opens them up to engage. And this opens Gideon up to engage. God says, I think you're so valuable, I'm going to trust you to actually help my people out here. That's how valuable I think you are. I'm sending you. What God is doing is tending to Gideon. So we talked about God naming. God's also tending Gideon. Of course, Gideon comes back with what? I'm not enough. I'm youngest. My family isn't a big deal in this place, which is not true, as we see. I'm not enough. Comparison, right? He compares himself. He's the least. He's the youngest. Again, this idea of scarcity has gotten to him. And what does God do about that? He's very gracious about it.
Oh, he's so patient.
He's so patient about it. He assures him this time, not only am I with you, Gideon, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to continue to be with you in the future, and I'm going to give you victory. So he continues to talk to his shame. You're valuable because I'm with you. You're going to always be valuable because I'm always going to be with you. I'm going to continue that. And then Gideon wants a little bit more, right? Gideon's asking, stay here while I go get a present for you. And I'll bring that here. Could you stay here? And could you show me that it is you, God, who's talking? Now, what you need to understand is they're still in a pluralistic place where Gideon's not quite sure. Maybe this is one of the gods. Maybe this is Baal talking to me. He's not quite sure. So what he asks, I want to know that it's you, Lord God, Yahweh, who's talking to me. So could you give me a sign? He asks. And the Lord, again, is completely gracious to him, right? He actually gives him a sign. What we see from Gideon, though, is what does Gideon bring as a gift?
Are you talking about the first?
Yeah, thing? Yeah. Meat.
Unleavened bread.
Broth and bread.
Broth and bread, right? How precious is that to Gideon?
Probably very precious.
Yeah, remember? They don't have any food. The Midianites had taken it. So what he gives is actually a big sacrifice. It says, I think you're God. I'm not completely sure, but I think so. And I think so, I'm going to put on the line something that's really precious to me. I'm going to give it over to you. And God graciously, of course, sets it on fire, receives that. And in that, he says, Gideon, don't be afraid. I'm bringing you peace. I'm bringing you shalom. In my presence is fullness. So that shalom is that absolute fullness, that, oh, everything is right with the world kind of feeling. It's not the absence of battles out there. It is the feeling of fullness here. And that's what God gives to Gideon at that time. And he says, he lets him experience that the God with us is our fullness. That's where we have enough, with God's presence with us. That's where we have enough. So the tending that God gives to Gideon is, he says, I will graciously listen to you. Do you notice that God is always listening here? Gideon keeps talking, and God listens. And he graciously listens, right? Remember we practice listening, not waiting for us to be able to talk? That's God here, right here. Listening to Gideon, listening to all of his excuses, his comparisons, his model of scarcity. And he meets Gideon right where he's at in order to give Gideon what he needs to grow and to see that God is enough. This is tending. This is how we tended our plants, right? We looked at the plant, and if it was bent over, we listened to the plant, right? Oh, looks like it might need water, so I'll give it water. If it was yellow, oh, it looks like it might need fertilizer. God listens. Listening is part of tending. What does Gideon need? This is what Gideon needs right now, and I'm going to give it to him so that he can grow and see I'm enough. Gideon has all he needs in God's presence. So this is what God does. At the very beginning, he warns, he names, and he tends. And now we have God and Gideon together. Now we kind of have a team here. Why does God do what he does with Gideon? Why does he name Gideon and tend Gideon? Because it gives Gideon the ability to do the same to God. It gives Gideon the ability to build an altar, right? So, to build an altar, there's two reasons you build an altar. One is to make a memorial to say this person was worthy of something, right? So we have headstones when people die. Some man in India built a whole building for his wife when she died. Anybody know what that's called? Okay, so the Taj Mahal is a tombstone, basically, saying, my wife was so valuable to me. This is how valuable. That's an altar. So Gideon first does that. He builds an altar to say God is worthy. And when he says what he calls it, says God is enough. An altar is also a place that I can actually give over something that's valuable to me to say this person is more valuable than what I value. And Gideon is able to do that as well. God names and tends Gideon so that Gideon can name and tend God. So Gideon, after he's named and tended, Gideon names God, and he names him, the Lord is peace. He says, God is enough. God is my fulfillment. God is where I find fulfillment, fullness, rest. And then, since tending is listening to what you need so that you can grow, Gideon does the same to God. He tends to his words, to God's words, his instructions, so that God can grow. And I'm going to put that in quotes, but you know what I mean, I think. so that God's presence can be received in more and more places. It's there. It doesn't really grow, but so that it can be received and experienced, that meaning of growing. So he listens to God's instructions about making space for God's name to grow, for God's presence to grow. He replaces an altar of scarcity with an altar to the Lord God. In that, he is proclaiming God is enough. He puts that altar right on top of the God of scarcity. It's not true that there's scarcity. It's not true that there's not enough. God is enough. This is where I always find enough, and I will be enough in God. And that's why he makes that altar. And he offers a burnt offering. And if you remember our Levitical study, a burnt offering was one, it was actually the first offering every day at the tabernacle as well as the last. And it was a praise to God to say God is enough. God is all we need for life. It is the source of life. The two bulls he uses for this would have been very costly for Gideon and his family. Very costly. And yet he makes a public proclamation that it is enough. Now, we notice he does this at night, right? We still see his fear. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a beautiful picture we see with Gideon. He's very fearful at the beginning. He's hiding. Now, although he's done it at night, so he's still fearful, but he's made a very public proclamation, God's enough. So we see a movement, right, for Gideon. What we don't see is Gideon go from fear to absolute confidence, because that's not how it happens. It's always a process, and that's what we see with Gideon. So we've seen that he's lost some of his fear and that he's making a public proclamation that God is enough. Why else is God doing what he's doing? Why is he naming Gideon and tending to Gideon's needs as he's fearful? Because it gives others an example to be able to do the same thing that Gideon does. And now we see Joash, Gideon's father, following in his son's footsteps in some way, right? He starts to let go of some of his fear. He begins to refute the shame and the disengagement. He is no longer disengaged. He's out there, and he's going to defend God, not Baal, right? He's going to say, if Baal is really a god, if this god of scarcity is really valuable, let him show us how valuable he is. Right ahead. And I'm sure that that would have brought thoughts to you of somebody else that did that, right? Elijah, right? Elijah does the exact same thing. Let the gods show us how valuable they are to us. And this is what Joash does. But he does it because his son took the first step. His son went first and did it. Even in his fear, he was able, this first step of faith, he was able to bring somebody else to do that as well. But it also riles up the enemy. So don't think that we take one step of faith, oh good, now I don't have to be in battle. Because it does just the opposite. It actually makes the battle come stronger, right? So it riles up the Midianites, and the Midianites actually come and get others as well, all the sons of the east. And when you see sons of the east, if you go back to that Abraham passage with Keturah, he says, when Abraham's still living, he sent all of his sons to the east. Oh, man, that's all these people that are coming here again. So it riles up the enemy. So just because I name God's worth and I say, no, I'm not going to have anything to do with God's scarcity, or at least I'm going to start to do that, and I tend to God's instructions, it is not a transaction. I don't name and tend God because then my life will be okay. Right? We've talked about this a million times, but we still want to do it. Mm-hmm. Oh, and this is how I've seen judges use it this way so many times. Well, what does the leaders do? Well, let's do what the leaders do, because then we won't have battles. You will have battles. God wants you to have battles. They're good for you. So don't think that if I just name and tend God, I'm not going to have battles. If I name and tend God, what are we promised in the New Testament? You will have tribulation. You will have battles. The battles will actually come up, and that's good. Because then you can confront them and make sure that you battle against them. And in riling up the enemy, it provides the opportunity for all of the culture to come against the God of scarcity, for God's people here. So he calls other tribes to join the fight. The fight against the God of scarcity cannot be personal only. And we're going to see what happens when we think it's only personal. I only have to battle it in my own life. If you think that's true, then just wait a little bit for Gideon and see what happens when it's still in the culture, when it's still in the family. When you allow everybody else to keep the God of culture, of God of scarcity, it is going to come right back to you. It is so insidious. It will come back to you. So God gives an invitation to more of God's people to fight the God of scarcity. So now we have Gideon and God. We're going to reverse it. So we had God and Gideon because God was really the force behind this. Now we're going to have, what is Gideon doing with all this? And we have Gideon again testing God, right? Now he wants to test God. Oh, God, don't be angry with me. Don't be ashamed of me. I want to test. And in this test, he really is saying, I believe you, I think, but there's part of me that doesn't believe. There's part of me that's still fearful. So this is, I believe, help my unbelief. So it's a movement for Gideon. It's not a very mature move, but should we expect a mature move from someone who just came out of intense fear to a little less fear? Should he now zoom over to, I have complete confidence in God? That's not going to happen, right? It's going to be a progression. So we can't use it for, this is what we should do, but we also can't use it for, we should never do this. It's a progression in faith. And we know that because God's very gracious about it, right? Okay, Gideon, I'm going to do that. And he meets the test that God, that Gideon actually asks him for. Gideon is asking for more tending here. Could you tend me a little bit more? I'm still pretty weak here. I'm still a little fearful here. Could you tend me more? Yep, God says, I will. I'll meet you there. So a step of faith, he's already made a step of faith, right? He's torn down altars and made an altar to God. So God sees that there is progression here. It's not, Gideon isn't trying to get out of going there. Gideon is saying, I want to go there, not quite ready. Could you give me a little bit more tending? Could you help grow me a little bit more? And so God, of course, does that. So now we have Gideon ready for war. And we have Gideon I'm thinking through, I guess I should look at the, are we on chapter 7 here?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're in chapter 7, and we have Gideon bring the people, and they're ready to go to war. And now, God does a really funny thing. What just happened is Gideon tested God, right? Now what do we have?
God
tests Gideon. And what is he testing for? He wants Gideon. And this is what God says about all tests. He wants Gideon to know whether he still has a lot of fear or not. He wants Gideon to understand what's in Gideon's heart. So Gideon, I'm going to test you. And the funny thing is, he pretty much does the same kind of test. Where's water going to be? Is water going to be in the hand? Water going to be in the mouth? It's the almost same test that Gideon gave God. And Gideon would have realized this. Wow, this is a really interesting test. Because I just tested God about water too, where water should be. So God does this with Gideon for his good. So Gideon, I want you to see. Do you still have fear in me? Or do you have a little more faith? And out of this, Gideon obeys. Now this is a really concrete test for Gideon. Gideon, get rid of all the people until you have only 300 men. Now, interesting enough, and I wish I could go, everything that happens in chapter 6, 7, and 8, has a corresponding thing to what God told them in Deuteronomy. Everything, including this. He said, if people are afraid, don't let them go to war with you. Because afraid is an issue of worship. And then you won't be following God, you'll be following something else. So we have Gideon paring his army down to 300 people. Gideon has now just discovered, oh, I actually have a lot more faith than I did before. So the test was for Gideon to be able to see that he actually has more faith. But here's a neat thing. Now that Gideon does what God says he does, so now we have another step of faith, very concretely. He's torn down the altars. He's taken away all the men that were afraid. And now God says, so Gideon, I do understand that you could still have some fear, and I'm just going to give you something without you even asking, right? And this is that God will give above what you ask. This is God's tenderness in his tending of Gideon. And so God gives him this great, if you're still afraid, go down to the camp. And he gets to hear this enemy talking about being afraid of Gideon. Can you imagine Gideon, this man who was so afraid of the enemy, and now Gideon hears the enemy's afraid of him specifically. Wow, this is amazing for Gideon, and what a gift that God gave him. And he does this, so Gideon says, so that you can be strengthened. And the word strengthened is shazak. What does that mean?
Bound fast.
Bound fast to. It's a covenant term. It means to be bound fast to God. This word, shazak, is not the same word as power or I'm strong. It's the same word he uses with Joshua. Be strong, not in yourself. Hold on to me. Shazak. Mm-hmm. And he says, so I'm giving you this so that you hold on to me. I don't want you going into battle on your own. I want you to hold on to me. Make sure you're wearing that backpack, not this. And it seems as if Gideon has been able to take this backpack off, and now he goes into war with this backpack, with God. We have Gideon here, able now, and it specifically says worship. He bows and worships when God gives him this last bit of tending. God is enough. When I bow in submission, I say, yeah, your directions are good. That's a good way to go. My direction would have been still in the wine press. And then we have this whole section about trumpets. And I think trumpets is mentioned 7 times in this little section. And anytime you see that, you got to stop. What in the world is going on with trumpets? So these trumpets here are shofars. They are not musical instruments. Musical instruments did not enter Israelite worship until Solomon. So we're a long way from that. These are meant for announcements. So they would have used the shofar for 2 reasons. Number one, they used it on Rosh Hashanah, which was just last week, right, or a week ago. And Rosh Hashanah was the beginning of the new year. And what the new year affords worshipers, it is a worship time, and it affords worshipers to reset, to reorient themselves. So when a trumpet is brought in, it announces a change of mind. And we know that word, change of mind, as
repent.
It's not turn around, do the right thing. It's change your way of thinking.
Is that where they blow them at Yom Kippur?
Yep.
Like I heard it that last weekend.
Yes, exactly. Okay. That's exactly why. This is the time for you to change your way of thinking. Change the paradigm of the God of scarcity. And this is, Gideon has all of these men blow these trumpets. We're announcing, we have changed our mind. Scarcity is not true. We are not going to submit to the God of scarcity. The other reason they would have ever used a trumpet, a shofar, would be to announce a king. Announce a leader. And they're here saying, we have also changed leadership. We're not leading ourselves anymore. Because when we lead ourselves, we're hiding. When we submit to the God of scarcity, we're hiding. We are saying we do not submit to the God of scarcity anymore, and we are changing our leadership. We are going to follow the king. We are going to follow God. So we have these ideas underneath the uses of these shofars. And the shofars, it specifically says, are put in their right hand. So it's saying our strength comes from God being enough. That's where our strength comes from. Not from our weapons. They have no weapons in their hands, do they? But our strength comes from God being enough. From us allowing him to lead us and not worshiping God of scarcity, but worshiping him, saying he is enough for us. And it's so true, because they get the eyes to see. Do you realize the word that then is they stood and saw? They didn't fight here. They just stood and saw what happened. What happened to the Midianites? They were killing each other. They're completely confused. It's the watch change. It's night. No one in the Middle East at that time would have ever attacked somebody at night. And the watch change means no one's on watch. These people are leaving. These people are just coming. You know that kind of chaos it could have been. It's dark, and they're killing each other now. And Israel gets to stand and see. Just like at the Red Sea, stand and see the salvation of the Lord. And the army of Gideon gets to watch that. And now they're like, wow, God is with us. And now they want to participate. And they begin to chase then the Midianites that are fleeing. Notice that in each of the battles that we've seen God be victorious, the enemy flees. What does it say in the New Testament? Resist the enemy and he will flee from you. This is exactly what's happening here. So they pursue the enemy, and they pursue them to death, right? All the way to death. And they kill Zalmana and, what is it, Ziba? Not yet. We don't kill them. We're killing the Z people first, right?
No, I think there's...
Oh, you're right.
Oreb and...
Yeah. So we kill them. Where do we kill them?
Was one of them a wine press?
One of them's at a wine press, and one of them's at a rock.
The rock
where God was first named by Gideon, right? God, it brings to mind the rock. This is literary allusion. Gideon and we, the reader, should be, remember this was oral, so we hear rock. Wait. That's where Gideon named God as being enough, as being peace. And the other one is killed in his own wine press, where God named Gideon, right? Not the specific wine press, not the specific rock, the allusion to, remember, the rock and the wine place were the place of naming of worth. So we have this great Gideon with his backpack of God only has just defeated them, and all the men with him have defeated the enemy, the God of scarcity. This is great. Yay! And of course, after a battle like that and a victory like that, for all of us, right, when we're victorious about getting one of our idols out of the way, boy, we feel so good, right? And what happens after we feel successful?
We take credit ourselves.
we sometimes like take credit, right?
Relax.
And we relax, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, now it's good. And I'm going home. And I'm just going to be with my people, so it's good, right? But what we find is the battle is still at home. And this is what I mean by, it cannot only be a personal battle about the God of scarcity. Because the God of scarcity resides in your home as well. It resides with your people. It resides in the church. And you can't just do it for yourself. Because in the church, we worship the God of scarcity as well. And we have got to be willing to battle that. The thing is, Gideon's coming home and he is feeling pretty successful. And he's coming home, so he's thinking, this is a safe place. This is not a place I need to battle. And so he comes home, and the first people that he meets is the tribe of Ephraim, right? Now, he's called Ephraim in the battle, right? Ephraim has actually come into battle with him. But what does Ephraim say to him?
Why didn't you call us earlier?
Why didn't you call us earlier? What does Ephraim feel like they don't have enough of? Yeah, they don't have enough honor. You guys got a lot of honor out of that. We only got a little. We didn't get enough. And all of a sudden we see that the God of scarcity is still there, right? Within home, within the tribes of Israel. They don't have enough honor. Gideon is at a very weak place because he's been successful and because he's taken off guard because he's at home. How does Gideon answer them?
You've got
what did you just say?
Yeah, he compares. Yeah.
He compares.
Great vineyards, and we only have something.
And
I don't remember.
Comparing is a method of scarcity culture. What's happening to Gideon here? Gideon, all of a sudden, he's wearing this backpack. Ephraim's wearing this backpack, and he goes, "Oh, wow! Look at how much he has. I want to make sure to protect my honor too. I don't want them to think badly of me." Right? That's what he's thinking. I don't want, because it says their anger, they were angry at him. He doesn't want them to be angry, not thinking about, what does angry mean? It means shame. Oh, I need to address their shame and tend their shame. No. Now I'm ashamed. Maybe I don't have enough. I want to make sure that everybody likes me, so I'm going to flatter them. I'm going to exploit their fear and say, oh, but you're great. You're greater than me. You're greater than us. That's what it means there when he talks about your grapes are better than our grapes. It's such an interesting, there's so much in there, but I'm not going to go into too deeply. So we have Gideon being sucked into the paradigm of scarcity. He wasn't alert to the fact that it's still lurking there. And he gets sucked in as well. Ephraim doesn't feel they have enough honor. Now Gideon's fearing their anger. Oh, I'm fearing their anger. I'm ashamed. Maybe I need more honor. Maybe I need to protect my own honor.
So how could he have done it differently?
So what do you think?
God didn't answer the angry plea.
Right? He answered the shame, right? What's the truth?
Oh, God told him he was with him.
So yeah.
Gideon could have.
That's what you do?
Named Ephraim.
God was enough for you. Mm-hmm. What you got was enough. God says you're enough. You're valuable because God was with you and gave you exactly what you needed. Gideon needed to stand up for God's worth of them. God says you're enough. Now the problem is that because they're in scarcity, he's afraid that they won't accept that and they'll be mad at him, right? So he's afraid to be vulnerable. He's afraid to get wounded for their flourishing, which is what God has been trying to do.
It's like the balancing scales. Well, we got to do this battle, but look at how great your crops are.
Right,
or something.
Right. Instead, he can say, God says you're worthy because he was with you in that battle and he gave you enough.
It says in verse 3 that God has given the leaders, Oreb and Zeb, into your hands. And so it looks to me like they were the ones that were responsible for killing Oreb and Zeb. And why isn't that a way for Gideon to give them the honor? I don't see why. I don't read it that Gideon is, I don't know, I don't read it quite like you say. It just seems to me he's being humble and saying, your part in the battle was even better than my part in the battle.
Anytime we use comparison, we're always saying God was not enough. You're better than me. God never says anybody's better than anyone else. Comparison will always be a matter of, I want to make sure to build you up. Why do I build you up?
So you don't tear me down.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Pat, it looks kind of innocuous here, doesn't it? But we're going to see what happens to Gideon. This is where it begins. So you have to read the whole story to realize where Gideon ends up, to know how did he switch backpacks? And this is where it begins. When he uses comparison, and it says their anger subsides toward him. He got what he wanted, right? He didn't want them to be angry toward him. God was not worried about Gideon being angry against him, was he? Not worried at all. I want to tend you. Gideon's not tending them. Gideon's tending himself. And we know that because of where we find Gideon later on.
Is it wrong to tend somebody?
Hmm?
As long as you're not doing a comparison?
Okay, but comparison isn't tending.
Right, that's right. What I'm saying.
It's,
yeah.
It's putting on a face of tending.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Right, yeah. So, yeah, he should have tended them. And the best way to tend is to say, where's your worth? Your worth is in what God has done for you, which is, he begins with, right?
Right.
But then he tries to ease back on it. You're better. You're better.
Okay.
Okay? So, and what we see is just as Gideon was growing in his faith, now his faith is kind of going just a little bit downhill. Just a little. Not great. Just a little. But we see that scarcity is still a pull. And we definitely see scarcity in Ephraim. What Gideon is not being honest about is his own pull. Like, I'm still pulled by that. I'm still pulled by that. So we see, I'm trying to, 5 minutes, what do I go through? Really quick. So we see, he asks Sukkoth and Penuel to help him. They don't help him. This is just a little aside, but Sukkoth is actually tomorrow, by the way. The Feast of
Tabernacles.
So Sukkoth means tabernacle, where God dwells. Penuel means the face of God. So here we have two peoples who are named basically God is here, who will not join the battle against the God of scarcity because they're saving the bread for themselves, right? What we have here is this picture of, I think God is enough, but I'm not going to act like God's enough. I'm going to make sure I get what I need. I protect what I need. There's a whole lesson just in those two verses there. But that's what Sukkoth and Penuel are. We have, of course, Gideon getting a little bit angry with them, and he comes back. And anytime you see thorns, know it's going back to the Garden of Eden. It is being away from God's presence, being independent. Anytime we see thorns, we see that with them. And Gideon gives them, hey, this is what you've chosen. You say you're the face of God. You say where God, you are where God dwells. And yet you are not willing to let go of the worship of God of scarcity. You have just chosen independence. And you've just told the world God is not enough. When I choose independence, I say God is not enough. And I'm telling the world that with my name, face of God. And we talked about, where did we say we were face of God? Leviticus, I think. I think that was our thought from there. There's a lot more in there, but we find Gideon now being asked to rule, right? Rule over us. And Gideon says, no, I'm not going to rule over you. God rules over you. God is supposed to be your king. What's the very next word?
Yet.
Yet. As soon as you see that, you know that what was just said is not going to be played out, right? Mm-hmm. Gideon says, no, God should rule over you. Yet, Gideon does what?
He makes an ephod.
He asks them, throw in your earrings, and maybe out will come this wonderful image of God that we can worship. Does that sound like anybody?
Aaron.
It's the exact same situation that Aaron found himself in. Gideon does the same thing. He says one thing. God is your ruler. And that was what Aaron was saying. God is our, we want to worship God. Let's make something that we can worship. And Gideon does the same thing. And so he gets all of this gold jewelry from the Ishmaelites, which means the people that they just conquered, the Midianites, were called Ishmaelites because they were nomads, not because they were descendants of Ishmael. Okay. And they give them to them, to Gideon, and he makes this ephod out of the 1,700 shekels of gold. And I looked up how much, I think that was like about $1 million worth of gold. That's what I found. Yeah, that was a lot. He made into an ephod, and then, of course, Israel played the harlot with it, and it became a snare to Gideon and his household. Here's the deal with the God of scarcity. We've got to be honest. We've got to acknowledge where we're weak and tender. Because if we don't, we are at more risk of being hurt. Remember, this was some of the research that Brene Brown did. If you have a medical condition and you're not honest about it, you will, I wish Michelle hadn't left because Michelle experienced this. If you are not honest about whatever medical condition you are, you will do things you shouldn't be doing and get yourself in more trouble, right? They found that they did research on people with advertising. And they would interview people to say, you know, are you affected by advertising? Does it pull you? Does it tempt you? And the people who were the most affected in reality by advertising were which people? The one that said, I'm not affected by advertising. You must be honest about your weaknesses, about the pull of the God of scarcity, or you will be at risk of being hurt by it. You will be at risk by falling into that. And that's what happens with Gideon here. He's not honest about, wow, that Ephraim saying we want more honor, wow, I can feel like I want more honor. All he needed to do right there is, God, it feels like I want to get honor now. And you've named worth in me. I forgot that you named worth by being with me. And so it starts to pull him until he gets to this point where he actually is now getting honor for himself. So much honor that he's making an ephod. He is actually now usurping the place of the high priest because that was the only person who was supposed to have the ephod. And now he's going to say, I'm going to be the high priest. He usurps that. And the very end of Gideon's life is, of course, he has how many children?
70
sons, right? Yeah, 700, that would be a little hard. 70 sons with many wives. Again, there's lots of direct correspondence to Deuteronomy, but he has lots of this. Why? Why do men have so many sons in the Old Testament? That's their honor. It wasn't enough for Gideon to be the judge, the man who brought them out of oppression from the Midianites, from the God of scarcity. He needed to have more and more sons. And so he accumulated for himself wives, and he even named one of his sons Abimelech, which means, my father is king. So go back to, would you be ruler over us? Oh, no. I am not going to be ruler. God is king. And yet we find Gideon naming his son, my father is king. Which will lead us into even more degradation with Abimelech in the next sessions to come, which will be in 2 weeks. So Gideon's story isn't over with, even though we find, I think he died. Does he die at the end of this one? Yeah. As soon as Gideon was dead, the sons of Israel again played harlot with the Baals and made Baal-berith their god. That's interesting, the Baal of Covenant with their god. So we see the God of scarcity's insidiousness, that it has to be battled, and it has to be battled corporately as well as personally. That each of us have to be able to battle against that. And it always starts with receiving who we are, that God says we are his image, and that he is with us. if I don't receive that, if I don't put that backpack on and be connected, I will always want to put that backpack on. I will always feel that I won't have enough. And even with that backpack on, it's very easy to just turn my head and go, wow, look at that backpack. That is a pretty cool backpack. Wow.
It's got so much stuff.
It has so much stuff, right? That's exactly what happens with Gideon, and it happens with us. And so you see then why Gideon's story is such a foundational story in the book of Judges. The God of scarcity is underlying any other God that we're going to go toward. Because when I feel that I'm not enough and I don't have enough, I will accumulate other gods that will give me enough. Give me enough power, give me enough self-satisfaction, give me enough comfort, whatever it is. And we're going to continue to see that. So this is kind of a centerpiece of idolatry, is the God of scarcity. Father, thank you for this day, for bringing battles to us, particularly the battle of the God of scarcity. Father, we don't want to name worth to that paradigm that there is only enough worthiness to go around, because you have said we are each your image. We are valuable. You're with us. Father, may we walk with that backpack on. Only you. You're enough. You're enough for whatever we have today. You're enough for us to be image bearers. You're enough for us to have our identity, the potential of our identity, completely fulfilled as we walk towards you and in you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Go forth into the world in peace, rejoicing in the power of the Spirit.
Thanks be to God. All right, make sure you work on your maps. To bring maps, make sure you sign up for the field trip so I know how many to tell the ranger that is coming. And if anyone wants to bike, I am biking in about 15 minutes. So Diane and I, at least. Is anybody else biking? Yeah. Really? Wow. I know, and that's the thing. You get out of routine, and then all of a sudden you forget. Like, oh, I have that. I know.